and welcome to A Country Podcast, where we've been revisiting our youth and yours too by watching the most beloved and in its day the longest running drama series on Australian TV, A Country Practice. I'm Melanie Tate. Kim Lester is with me as usual. Hello, Kim.
Hi, Mel. And we have a very special guest with us. Some might say this is the Charles Bud Tingwell of cameos for this podcast, in that she is a total legend.
Total legend. And a legend of the world of A Country Practice,
Totally. Chez Robbie, welcome.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm very pleased to be here, although I have to say I could never grow a beard quite like Bud's Santa beard in these episodes we're about to discuss. Although I'm trying, you know, against my will, yeah, I'm trying.
I was going to say, Chez, like we're all heading into those years now where we're going to lose some of our estrogen, we're going to become menopausal. Who knows what the beard situation might be like
Indeed.
In 10 years'
That's
time.
That's right. It's a goal, yeah. Really. It's
fantastic.
A hair goal for
so
me.
Just don't lose hope. Don't lose hope. So, Chez, I was really surprised to learn this. You didn't grow up watching A Country Practice. So I wonder, how are you now Australia's foremost expert in it?
Yes, well, hard quiz, you've got my application. But, I didn't watch it as a child. It was one of those things. I'm the right age to have watched it as a child. But for some reason, every time I heard that theme music when it came on, it was like, this bloody show is on again. Like, you know, you just, when you're a kid and you just want to watch TV and it's the wrong damn show. Yeah, it's a bit like MASH. Like MASH seems to be always on whenever I wanted to watch something. But now, of course, I'm quite happy to watch MASH as well. But back in the day, those two definitely not. Yeah, so in the 2020 lockdown, we were looking for something to watch, and my husband said, oh, do you want to watch an episode of Country Practice? Because it had come on 7+. And I, just capitulated because why not? Had nothing better to do. And, that was it, really.
That's really
into Wandon Valley.
Yeah, that's so new. Very. What was that episode that you watched that got you hooked?
Oh, we started the pilot. We just started at the beginning. Yeah.
It's a cracker. An absolute cracker of a pilot.
It is. It is so good. And, after the first season or whatever, I had to – because, when you're watching – Netflix or something with somebody and you have to say, can I watch it by myself? Can I watch it when you're not here? And it became like that.
I just want to ask you more about that, actually, because I think, we both found, Kim, didn't we, when we got into it in 2020 during lockdown, we kind of loved the slowness of it and the sort of slow beauty of it. Was it a similar, what do you think it was that connected you so deeply to it so quickly?
Yeah, that's interesting because I'm a pretty slow person. just generally, I live a slow life. I'm, don't get out much. So it was more the storytelling for me, I think. It was the I have a lot of friends who are fictional characters. So, I was quite happy to add a few more to the old roster. Right. So,
Speaking of your friends who are fictional characters, you make – just the most wonderful crochet dolls of the A Country Practice cast. And you've just released, this is just this incredible stop animation version of the opening credits, which is on YouTube. And we've shared it on our Facebook page, but, make sure you go and have a look if you haven't seen it already. And it's got all of the cast all the way from 1981 to 1993. So first of all, when did you start going, I want to start crocheting these people?
Yeah, it was pretty early on, and it was Molly. And Molly isn't my favourite character by any stretch, but there was just something about her fashion that I said, I have to immortalise this in doll form. And, once she was done, that was away, I was committed then to the whole 40-odd characters.
I think that's how we became connected, Chez, because I said, do you do those for, order, and I ordered Molly and Esme, but I can't quite reach Esme from where I am, but Molly I'm holding up. You're amazing.
Oh, thank you so much.
Did you come up with your own pattern for them, or did you have a pattern for little person?
There's a very fantastic designer, crochet designer called Alison Hoffman, and she has a book called Amigurumi. So Amigurumi is making little creatures, little dolls, and it's basically a pattern where you can make whoever you like. It's just got some basic body shapes. So I just kind of riffed off that. And
it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's so fantastic.
I have a quiet dream to learn how to crochet, which I might be getting you to teach me, Shez, when we're not making a podcast anymore.
That's it. Definitely. Sounds good.
Well, speaking of not making a podcast anymore, this is our last episode for the next little while, meaning, you know, maybe the next couple of years. Maybe it's it. Who knows? So we're doing the finale today of episode 13. I mean, season 13. Not the finale of the finale, Kim. We just couldn't do the finale. We're doing the real finale, the proper finale.
I think most people, most sort of big true fans of A Country Practice don't even necessarily acknowledge the 1994 season of A Country Practice, and they definitely don't refer to the finale as the last episode of that season that just blew out with a whimper. So this finale is the last episode of season 13. It went to air in November 22, 1993. And let's do a little recap. It's the Christmas season, and the good folks of Wandon Valley are celebrating the centenary of the Wandon Valley Bush Hospital. The air is thick with nostalgia, especially for Esme and Frank, who are two of the only people who have lived in the valley long enough to remember the good old days. But it's business as usual at the hospital, which I've got to say is a much busier place than the quiet little bush hospital we first saw in that pilot in 1981. So it's just as well Matron Sloane just turns up just in time to put things back in order, and she brings her usual Maggie Stern demeanor with her. And let's discuss this later. I've got some thoughts. It's business as usual for Tom, who's dealing with a domestic violence order against a violent local farmer whose wife has finally and hopefully permanently managed to get away from him. The farmer is enraged, and when Tom goes to his house to seize a rifle, the man takes him hostage and then sets the place alight. And being Australians, we all know what can happen when a fire breaks out on a hot, dry, windy day in Australia, and it isn't long before the fire is out of control and threatening the town, including the hospital. Rewinding just a little bit, Charles Budd Tingwell has come to the valley, and if you were a fan of The Late Show, which was on around the same time, 1992, 1993, you just would have squealed with delight when Charles Budd Tingwell turned up. You're nodding, Shez. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Because of course, Budd Tingwell played Gramps on Charlie the Wonder Dog.
They just used to have this like funny little sketch on The Late Show called Charlie the Wonder Dog, and it was kind of a riff on Skippy, really. And in the theme song, I can't even remember quite how it goes. It was like,
Charlie the Wonder Dog, is there anything you can't do?
God.
Running, jumping, making us smile. Charlie, we love you.
Oh, you are great.
How could you forget?
I know. That should be imprinted like most of The Late Show. And it always sort of had that little bit where they said, who's in the cast? And then it said, and Charles Budd Tingwell as Gramps.
Gramps.
So it was a little like pop cultural moment to see Charles Budd Tingwell in A Country Practice. He is visiting Wandon Valley. He's known by a few different names. Some call him Nick. Others might call him Klaus. But most of us in Australia would know him as Santa. When he arrives at the hospital to give out some prezzies, Harry and Kate, is it Kate?
Yes.
It's Kate, isn't it? Okay. Harry and Kate are concerned for his mental state. Is he just a doddery old man who thinks he's Santa, and where did he come from? But they're so busy that he disappears before they can find the answers to get him help. He gets lost in the bush, and the fire is closing in on him. Meanwhile, Vicky has come back for the centenary celebrations, and whoops, she accidentally runs over Fatso. So she and Anna have to operate on him. By the way, Anna thinks she may be pregnant, but there's really no time to get into that right now. Terrence and Rosemary are the last to leave the hospital, but when they dash back inside to make sure that it's fully evacuated, they too get trapped. Here is where we get a very valuable community service announcement about sheltering in place during a bushfire. Did you pick up on that? It sort of told us everything we need to do. Block the doors with towels so that the smoke doesn't come in. Don't open the door when the fire's going past, because that will make the fire come into the room. And I've got to say that I think that they know a lot more about the do's and don'ts of bushfire than anyone who's stuck in the bush. At one point, Darcy and Billy also get lost in the bush. And who should come to the rescue but Luke?
Out of nowhere. He materializes.
Out of nowhere. Yeah. And with his full Air Force uniform on, it was like, how can we make this as much like an officer and a gentleman as we possibly can? I just really wanted to hear, and love lift us up where we belong. It's a beautiful reunion, except I was getting really stressed out because they were taking time to reacquaint themselves and kiss when they should have been getting the hell out of the burning bush. It stressed me out. Claire finds poor old Santa in the bush and Ian is winched down from a helicopter to rescue them. And while they're waiting out the fire, Terrence and Rosemary promise that if they survive, they'll get married. Finally, the fire passes through and all of our regulars make it out alive. A month later, the citizens of Wandon Valley gather for their 8th wedding in 13 years.
Oh, good stats. Good stats, Kim.
You like that one?
Yeah.
It's the nuptials of Terrence and Rosemary. Yeah, one of which was actually Terrence's. But anyway, Terrence has arranged the celebrant, a woman, at Rosemary's insistence. In fact, it's a woman they know. It is Bernice. I have a question about that, Chez, but we'll get to that in a moment.
No worries.
Everyone gets a chance to wave goodbye at the end as Terrence and Rosemary go off into the sunset. And it looks like they're all wondering what will become of their burnt out shell of a town. Can they rebuild, or will just a select few of them be chosen to reestablish?
In a lush green valley.
In a lush country town in Victoria, leaving the rest of them to live out some type of Armageddon in the alternate Wandon Valley. Chez, I have questions.
I'm ready.
For somebody who has not watched the entire series.
I cannot believe you've watched the whole series in 2 years, Chez, you legend. You're amazing.
And I'm a bit slow. I'm a bit slow compared to some of the other fans. But also I got there in the end.
To remember it as well. That's the other thing. Like, I can't remember. I feel like the most recent thing I binged watched was that one about Anna Delvey. I can't even remember what it was called now. Finding Anna or Missing Anna or something like that on Netflix. It was the biggest thing for about a week. Can't remember any of it.
I can't remember any of it. My thing is that each day I do Wordle and then 10 minutes later I can't remember what the word was.
Of course. Kim, do you think
then you can do it again?
Do you think that it comes from like being in radio, Kim? Like, so we used to produce, we'd do like 12 stories a day in radio, and I can still remember getting home at night and my flatmate or my family saying, "What did you do on the show today?" And I'd be like, "You know what? I don't know. I can't remember."
I know. It could be that I've always been a forgetful person though. Like, I remember when I was 16 and I was catching the train to Brisbane and Mum was driving me to the train station and we were like probably 2/3 of the way there and I just went, "Oh, I don't think I've got my train ticket." Like, that was just me to a T. I don't know how I actually managed to be a reasonably successful radio producer. Because anyway, so first of all, why doesn't Rosemary like Bernice?
Essentially, it's because the thing that we all suffer with on this pod is that Bernice is
in love with
cracking onto Terrence.
Yep.
Terrence. Yeah.
I don't know that she's in love with him, but she certainly sees it as a good bit of fun
with him a lot
on the side. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Rosemary, of course, doesn't like that.
Did they ever hook up?
No, not to my knowledge.
Not consummated.
That's not on the screen.
Oh, can you imagine moving to a country town as a single woman and discovering that the local doctor was Dr. Terrence Elliott and that he was single? Like, can you imagine?
Not only single, but also loves to love. Like, yeah. I think that would be the thing. Like, you'd be with, "I'm in with a shot here."
But also, can you imagine being halfway up the aisle and finding out that your celebrant, which for some reason you didn't have a hand in organising, was a woman who you don't like because she used to flirt with your husband all the time? Terrence, that was a bad call. Next. Speaking of being halfway up the aisle, why does she start questioning the institution of marriage halfway up?
Yeah, well, Rosemary's first husband died. Their kind of origin story of coming into Wandon Valley was that Rosemary's husband had died. He'd been shot in Africa. Their family was there doing some medical you know, stuff over there.
Had they also adopted a little baby that was addicted to heroin? And
no,
had,
they hadn't, unfortunately. That was, you know.
That was a different character as played by previous.
Yeah.
Same actor, different character.
That's right. Exactly, yes. Yeah, so, and her husband had been kind of seen as sort of a big hero and he was doing such wonderful things, but hadn't necessarily been quite as attentive to his family. So she was sort of dealing with issues about having been married before and Terence having been married before, and she kind of just wanted their relationship to stay as it was. Mm. And there was another episode in which Terence almost proposed and she kind of said, no, we'd agreed that we're going to be mutual supports for each other and we don't need to get married and that sort of thing. Yeah. And can I just have a shout out to Josie Ryan, who gave me the tip off for that because I couldn't exactly remember myself.
No, thank you, Josie.
Josie is the leading expert on Rosemary Fire. So,
oh, great.
How many times has Terence, is this Terence's third marriage or is it like his fourth?
It's his third and fourth engagement because he was engaged to Marta.
Fourth engagement.
Yeah. Right. Fourth, yeah. Okay.
That we know of.
Yes.
I always remember when one of my cousins married somebody who'd been married twice before. He was like 28 and he'd been married twice before. And my mother saying, well, the writing was on the wall, wasn't it? But when someone is like Terence's age, so he's in his 50s by now, two marriages is fair play, don't you think? I was thinking though, if I could understand if the new matron, why do I, Rosemary, if she was reticent after three marriages, if he'd had three marriages under his belt, then I can see her reticence. But otherwise, marry that silver fox, nail him down. You know what, don't you think it's wonderful? I think it just, like, Kim, you and I have a very good friend who has been married five times.
Do
we? In Canberra, yes.
Do I know that they've been married five times?
She's one of the most delightful. Yeah, you do. Yep. Because she always tells everybody about it. She's one of the most delightful people.
Of course, of course.
Yeah. And to me, whenever I hear that story about her, she is the most delightful, open-hearted, beautiful person. And I always think she just loves to love. Mm. Like, go for it. But a man that's been married five times is a different story, don't you think?
He just loves to be fed.
Yeah.
Yes.
My final question to you, Shez, why, I should know this. This is embarrassing that I don't know this. Why does Frank work at the pub?
After Frank kind of gets rid of Alf Muldoon, he decides he's going to retire. And, of course, Tom Newman, the new copper, which I said not to call him last week, he comes in. So Tom has come in to be the new policeman. Frank is retiring. And at this point, Hugo is running the club because Bob and Cookie have left. Uh-huh. And at one point, there's a sort of a bar brawl and Hugo gets his finger dislocated in the melee. Uh-huh. And Frank is sort of there and they say, oh, can you just mind the bar while Hugo goes and gets medical attention? And Frank does, and he doesn't mind doing it. He enjoys it. And so from that, he decides that he's going to take over the club. Mm. And because he explains to Hugo in that episode that he wants to continue being a barman as a teetotaler because then he can kind of make sure that nobody drives home drunk.
He still wants to protect and serve.
Bless him.
Yeah. He does. He still wants to be a policeman without being a policeman.
And you know what?
Really,
Frank could never. He has to have something to do and to be working. Mm,
exactly.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bless him. I love how he's a teetotaler. You know what?
Teetotaler.
I can never. How he doesn't drink. How he has his orange juice.
That's right.
I find Frank a very attractive man, except for his personality. Like the things that.
Did you say that round the wrong way?
No. Because I just find him a bit too grumpy and know-it-all sometimes. Right. But. The roses, the singing, the amateur dramatics, the drinking orange juice is all very on brand for me in terms of a gentleman friend, but his the whole copper thing's not.
Not so much.
You know, yeah.
Not for you. Fair enough.
Oh, I don't have a license at the moment. How could a copper have a wife that doesn't have a driver's license because she lost it? You know what I mean? Like, I'm a mess.
I mean, look.
You sound like Shirley, yeah. I think. Really?
Yeah, but it wouldn't work. You just know it wouldn't work in real life. Do you know what I mean? Like you can see it barely worked on a country practice. Like, can't you just see every now and again you can see the tension between Frank and Shirley? You can see them actually acting like they like each other.
That's just every marriage once in a while, really.
I'm glad you said that, Kim, because I was weighing up whether or not to say that. But yeah.
Okay, let's get into some of the meatier bits of the episode. How do you think they handled the domestic violence in the episode? How do you think they handled, I guess, that issue?
Well, it seemed to me from watching it this time that, look, it felt like they really felt like we've moved nowhere on domestic violence since then, because the writers of this episode knew all the issues with domestic violence. The one thing that didn't ring true to me is I felt like Tom the new copper. Tom the copper. In the bit where he was holding Tom hostage for a minute, Tom was kind of inflaming him, and I thought that wouldn't really be the case. But it seemed that everything else, like the more things change, the more they stay the same. A little bit like it felt like a fairly progressive view of domestic violence to me. What did you guys think?
I feel like in this episode, they needed a way to set the town on fire. They dealt with domestic violence so many times across the series and dealt with it quite well that bit, like you said, we just assume that the woman has got away and thank God she's away you know, and that they couldn't resolve anything to do with that. It was just a starter issue to sort of get things moving.
It was a really small, in the grand scheme of things, it was actually a really small issue that didn't even involve a guest character of the woman at all. It was very much just, you know, which, okay, that's, yeah, like it wasn't it wasn't what the episode was meant to be about, but it was, yeah, you're right. No. It's interesting that they used domestic violence as a starting point, but also I thought it was interesting that they used it to demonstrate that it extends beyond just being something that happens between two people within a household, which is absolutely bad enough and all of that, you know, but also that anger that comes from being rejected or from being questioned or whatever he was going through that, you know, manifested in that rage puts so many people at risk. You know, it puts women at risk. It puts their children at risk. It puts, you know, police officers at risk. It puts broader community members at risk in so many different ways. And I thought that was an interesting point to make.
And especially as Tom drags him out of the car later to go, look what you've done.
Yes.
Look what you've done.
I assumed he was dragging him out because it wasn't safe to be in, like to drive out. I thought, oh, he's rescuing him or something.
Exactly. No.
This was an interesting one to watch. This isn't the first bushfire episode we've watched. It was, in terms of just the depiction of the bushfire, it was so good, wasn't it? Like the scenes with actual footage of fires were blended in so well, I thought.
And the frantic nature of the community hub trying
really
to fight
frantic.
It. And and how that had just completely amped up between episode one and episode two. We were like, boom, in the fire.
Yes.
You know, like it was.
Everything changes so quickly when a fire rips through town. It's just you have to respond quickly. And you have to know if you live in a small town, if you live in a bushfire prone area, you have to know what to do. And I don't know. I watched it and I also thought, and I don't know that I can identify exactly why I thought this, but I really did feel like a lot has changed since Black Saturday.
Yeah.
Black Saturday changed us in so many ways, but in terms of our bushfire response.
Well, don't you think also to the point where when I was watching this, I was thinking, same with, like, remember ABC had that show on earlier this year that was a mini series about the Black Saturday fires?
Mm-hmm. I didn't see it.
No, neither did I, because none of us lived through those fires. Like, we all live in different parts of Australia, but like there is a collective national trauma around those fires. And the minute I saw those ads for it, I thought, no, I don't think we're ready for this.
Yeah.
And I also don't think what the future looks like for Australia in terms of bushfire and flood. I don't think we need, I don't want to watch this story. I don't need to be reminded of this because we're seeing it every night on the television. And I even thought watching these episodes, how triggering and upsetting they would be for people who've gone through bushfire or live near bushfire regions, because it was so, and it made me wonder whether bushfires were not quite as frequent back then.
What was there between Ash Wednesday and the Canberra bushfires? There definitely would have been bushfires in in pockets of the country, but it's those big ones, you know, like Ash Wednesday.
There was Canberra and
Canberra.
I remember in 2001 or 2001 over Christmas, there were bushfires in the Blue Mountains. So they were big bushfires, Blue Mountains 2001. When were the Canberra ones?
Canberra was 2003.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Black Saturday was
2008,
2009? I think it was 2009.
Yeah, I think it was I was in Darwin. I always remember from where I was broadcasting. Does that make – are you the same, Kim? And I was in Darwin for those. I think it was 2008 or 2009, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and so but I think the thing with Black Saturday is just that so many people died. I mean, that death toll was horrendous. Yeah. So it led to, you know, a raft of inquiries and a royal commission and all of that, and you know.
Well, you notice that one of the advisories that they give us in a country practice, which obviously we know they would have researched really well, was to stay at home, because that was the directive until and it absolutely isn't since
Saturday. It's leave if it's safe. Like, if I think it's that if you're going to stay and defend, you need to know how to defend. And if you're going to leave, you need to leave with plenty of time. You can't wait until the last minute to leave, because then it's too dangerous to be on the roads. People die in car accidents as a result of not being able to see.
This country, it's so scary, isn't it, into the future?
Yeah, yeah. So something slightly lighter to finish on. okay, what did you think of Maggie in this episode?
Shez Wanos, you go first.
Yeah, I was thinking one of my notes that I wrote down was, to imagine the smiles that there would have been on the audience's faces when they heard Maggie's voice.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, three quarters of the way through that first episode, there's her voice and like,
yeah,
there she is. Woohoo.
You're so nice to think of the audience, because all I could think of was like how irritated I would be if I was going about my business working in a hospital and this woman just marched in and started bossing me around. Who didn't work there? I've no idea who you
are.
That's
true.
Yeah. No.
Like she's escaped from the Gilroy wing or something.
I felt like things were intensifying, like the mayhem of the place was intensifying when she came in. Yeah. And I was a little bit like, thank God Maggie's here. Yeah. We can all relax. She's going to sort it out. She's going to be fine. Yeah. Because Terrence and Rosemary were away talking to that old bloke, remember?
Yes.
And so Maggie was, I felt like, you know, like Kate and Harry, I mean, they just didn't know their ass from their elbow and they'd lost patience. Santa Claus had vanished, you know, like they
That's
had,
right.
you know, I felt like it was like order was restored and a little bit of cheeky order as well. You know how she had her little smiles and cheekiness.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I love her desperately. Don't you guys? Like,
she's
absolutely and deeply. I think she's my favorite character. Although why is she not Matron Sloan anymore? She's like Morrison. Why can't she just be Joan? Oh, no, that's because she's not Joan. She's Maggie.
Oh, you're funny. All right. So should we talk a little bit about what was happening at
what
the time?
The
and a little bit about, I guess, the
response.
I didn't script this part. The things that people said about it.
I'm a little bit scared about this. I hope that people were respectful when this ended.
Yeah, so these went to air. There was a 90-minute special that went to air afterwards that was all about the history of the show.
Oh.
And you can see that on our Facebook page. Thank you to wonderful Shez for having shared that. But I just thought that this story on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald that day just really took me, because it's this country that we live in, you know, like.
Was it the more things change, more things stay the same again?
Yeah, all three of us have just been in some way or another through a natural disaster, in that, you know, Shez and I are in Brisbane, you're in Sydney, there have been floods. Mm. One of our really good friends, Mel, has lost her house, you know, like this country. And on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald is an article about a storm that just ripped through a town and in a matter of minutes just destroyed several buildings and left nobody unaffected. So it says it lasted 20 minutes, and by the time it was over, it had devastated the small northern New South Wales town of Tucabia. Do you know that town?
No.
It's near Grafton.
Oh, well, it's probably copped it a few. It probably copped it a few days ago as
it
well.
It would have done too. Yeah. It would have done too. The storm, which began about 9 p.m. on Saturday, destroyed the church, demolished 8 homes and unroofed 45 in the farming town of 400, 16 kilometres northeast of Grafton. Like, just this country, you know, like, yeah, we put up with a lot. So that really stuck out for me, considering that this whole final episode was centered around a massive natural disaster. I also just wanted to point out that the number one song of the time was All That She Wants by Ace of Base. Oh, do you remember that one?
Which, yeah, because you know that, you know how there's that that game Wordle, there's also a hurdle.
Yeah.
And I've got to confess, I got All That She Wants by Ace of Base number
straight
one.
Straight away.
Straight away, yeah.
I got it in two because I got it mixed up with the other Ace of Base song.
Oh, damn.
I knew it straight away. Can I just tell you something silly though?
Please.
Today, so I'm in a little, I'm in a group called Curdle, which is cousins who wordle. And my two of my sisters and my cousin, we just share it. We just share, we do all the games. That's so cute. Like we do.
Curdle framed.
Wordle, Quirtle, which is what's four Quirtle? Of them. What's Quirtle, Quirtle, you do four words.
Right. Oh my gosh.
Hurdle.
Yeah.
Worldle. Which is where you're guessing a world, like a country.
Yep.
And framed.
Oh, how good.
Yes. We don't do Nerdle. Oh. I don't know that anyone's, you know, floated the idea of doing the maths one.
Did you get stuck with framed with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou by the O not being OH?
No, no. No, that didn't happen.
I guessed that first one and I put OH for instant.
Oh.
Thinking of Oh Brother.
Damn.
Yeah. And damn. Now I look like a filmic moron because
day ruined.
Yeah.
So anyway, speaking of hurdle, so today's song, and sorry, Sheds, if you're hanging out to do your hurdle, tell me not to reveal it right now.
Oh, it was so tricky.
Now's your chance. Chris got it before the music kicked
Stop
in.
Stop it.
Just by the by. Anyway, so today's hurdle was Wannabe. And oh God, this is such a boring story to keep in the podcast. I don't know if I should, but when I was looking up what's the number one song, I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, the number one song when this episode went to air was Wannabe by the Spice Girls. And I messaged it to my Curdle group and I was so excited. And then I realized I was looking at the wrong
year.
I was looking at 1997. And if I'd thought about that for more than 3 seconds, I would have remembered that the Spice Girls weren't around in 93. Anyway, good story, Kim. So what I want to share with you is just a little bit. I found this great article. This actually went in the Sydney Morning Herald. It was kind of the TV guide, The Week, I think it was called, magazine before the episode went to air. But I just thought this has some great little recaps of the series as a whole. So I thought I might share that with you. In television, as in life, people often try to imagine what if. With A Country Practice, the creator and executive producer of the series, Jim Davin, wonders what if Channel 10 had picked up an option for the series back in 1979 and not 1993? Would it have been as successful? Would it? 79 was when he did the competition and Channel 10 had the option. Would it have lasted as long? On the Channel 7 network, A Country Practice has lasted longer than any other Australian-made television drama, 12 years and 1,057 episodes. And let's just leave it at that. No, actually, Channel 10 is about to pick it up. On Channel 10, who knows? I really liked this part of the article. Just for ACP fans, here are some highlights of those great 12 years. Wandon Valley, the fictional setting for A Country Practice, has had its share of hatches, matches and dispatches. Among the babies born were Chloe to Molly and Brendan in 1982 and twins to Vicky Bowen in poor Simon doesn't get a look in here, to Vicky Bowen, Dean, well, there was always
she always had chemistry with Terrence, so maybe they're casting an aspersion on the paternity of these
team
twins.
Terrence.
Yeah.
That was in 1985. There have been eight made. I'm sure there were more babies than that. I think this writer stopped watching after a little while because didn't Matt and Lucy had a baby.
Matt and Lucy had a baby, yes.
And and of course, Alex lost a baby.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Anna is pregnant.
Molly lost a baby.
By the last episode, Molly lost a baby. Anyway, yeah. Okay. this article's getting debunked. There have been 8 major weddings in 12 years, beginning with Shirley Dean and Sergeant Frank Gilroy in episodes 53 and 54 in 1982. Then came Simon Bowen and Vicky Dean in 1984, Terence Elliott and Alex Fraser in 1988, Joe Loveday and Michael Langley in 89, Ranger Kathy Hayden and archaeologist John Freeman in 1990, Lucy Gardner and Matt Tyler in 1992. And last year, Anna Lacey, not Anne, married Sergeant Tom Newman, not the new copper, twice in episode 968. If you've been counting, you'll know that's only 7 weddings. The 8th will be the final episode on a 7 when the now divorced Dr. Elliot will marry matron Rosemary Pryor. Among the dispatches, and look, I've made a major discovery here that I need to talk to you two about. Among the dispatches, one of the most memorable death scenes was in 1985 when Molly Jones died from leukemia. Other deaths in this series include Donna Manning's death in a car accident in 87. Dr. Elliot's daughter, Sophie, died from a heroin overdose in 1988. Stephanie Brennan died when her horse was shot from under her in 1991. And Shirley Gilroy died in a plane crash in June last year. Did no men die in Wandon Valley? This is all women. Do we know? Did any male cast members die?
It is a shocking revelation. the only one that I can think of is Molly and Brendan's baby, Christopher.
Yeah, which
yeah,
which,
but yeah. He wasn't a cast member. A major character, obviously. Yes.
Wow, is that amazing? I wonder why that is. I wonder if it's because if you think, like, have a little bit of a think of your favorite TV shows. It tends to be women that die, like in A Secret Life of Us. Remember when the girlfriend died at the in that series?
I've never watched that. That was going to be a country podcast. Mark II was me finally watching A Secret Life of Us.
Well, somebody died. It's always if you just think about it in these shows, it's all. Let's think about Neighbours. Who died in Neighbours? Kerry died with the ducks, being shot with the ducks.
Madge.
Did Madge die?
Madge and Dee.
Harold disappeared. He got to live.
Well, Dee didn't die. Anyway.
Dee didn't die. Oh, was that?
Well, she died and then came back.
Did she come back? Oh, see. Yeah.
Deaths always tend to be women. Is that because we just care about women more and it's better ratings?
It's the crime drama trope, isn't it? Like women always die in crime dramas. But who knew that it was also the drama trope?
Yeah. But it's kind of not like, you know, with the dead women in crime drama, it's kind of porny and gross in that. I don't think that this is porny and gross. But it's weird, isn't it?
It's who just would very
you
interesting.
Who would you have killed off and how?
Right. So Matt Tyler. What could have happened to Matt Tyler? No, poor John. Cookie could have died a pretty fun death. Maybe
nude skydiving Cookie or something. I could see
what
him.
Are their shenanigans? Just finally went horribly wrong.
Well, they gassed themselves making the gin in the national park.
Yes. Well, they did nearly kill themselves a number of times, didn't they? I suppose.
Exactly.
Who else was there? What other blokes were even on the show that we? I mean, I don't think we could have ever killed off Dr. Terence. That wouldn't have been right. Like he's somewhere gardening. In Wandon Valley, having a nice retirement.
But in the Armageddon Wandon Valley, not in the Victorian.
Oh, he
Wandon
stayed.
Valley.
He stayed to rebuild for sure.
Yeah, yeah. You maybe know? It's not Armageddon because he
yeah, because he made it beautiful.
He
again.
Had it in hand.
Yeah. That's
now that you've said that though, I've just realised that a lot of the men had life threatening illnesses that they recovered from. Like Simon had encephalitis. Michael Langley had that terrible motorbike accident.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Matt Tyler had something. And Ben Green, the vet, had a spinal injury. Oh. He was in the hospital for months and months.
But they all
maybe
covered.
The men get terribly injured. They all covered, yeah.
We kill women, but we like to make men
suffer. That's right, exactly. Yes. To make us love them more, probably.
Maybe. Mello and Shezo, what do you want to talk about next?
Well, I just thought I'd take a little bit of a sneaky look at where some people are now. Like, this is the where are they now? Just a few of the characters to see what they're up to these days. What do you reckon? Because we've been through quite a lot of them on this podcast who were in this episode. There's a few we haven't. So I thought I'd start with, let me just get my script out so I know that. Okay. I thought we'd start with Jamie Croft, who plays Billy. Now, you know, interestingly, have a guess. Just have a guess. What's the first number that comes into your head? How old do you reckon Jamie Croft would be now?
35.
He'd have to be our age,
surely. He's our age. I couldn't believe that. He's 40. So we could have been on A Country Practice as Billy. We could have had our moment.
So I always wanted. He was 13 on A Country Practice.
Yeah, he was actually, I think that he was a lot younger than he. No, he wasn't. No, because he's 40. Little. We're 42. So he was.
Oh, yeah.
He was so 11 or something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, he was born 4th checks. Of August 1981. So he's a year younger than me, which is.
He's only a couple of months older
than
me.
So you're 81. You
younger than me. Younger than me. Younger than me. Younger than me. Yeah.
Look, the amazing thing about him is that he went on to have like a really quite a full career. He did loads and loads of TV, particularly kids' TV and voiceovers, etc. And now, though, I thought this was pretty interesting. He's married to the actress Saskia Burmeister, who I don't know if you remember Hating Alison Ashley. Do you remember that book and movie? Whoever whatever the girl's name was that wasn't Alison Ashley, you know, the one that hated Alison Ashley, Saskia Burmeister played her. Anyway, so they've been married forever. They got married really young. They had kids like in 2012 or something like that, like ages ago. And they've now, by the look of things, according to their IMDb, and we know that the IMDb is not that reliable, but we also know that I love a good little Facebook stalk. I love to Facebook stalk. And it looks to me now like they have a music business and they do music for television and film together. That's what I think that they do these days. But that's just according to a deep dive on their Facebook pages. Do you think it's me?
Reconnaissance.
Yeah, what do you think about getting this information from people's Facebook pages? I think, like, clamp it down, people, if you don't want podcasts.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
If it's public, it's public.
Exactly. Yep. If you don't want people to find out stuff about you, clamp it down. Okay, so the next
their address is blah, 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 and their dog's name is...
I can tell you their kids' names. Like, no, I won't do that.
Don't do that.
Yeah, I won't do that. So the next person I thought we'd go to would be Anne Luby, who plays Anna, the vet, who can't – I didn't know that you can't use that stuff that knocks people out if you're pregnant. You know how she's like, I can't operate on Wombat, on Fatso, because – isn't that what she was saying? That she,
cause yes.
She
yeah, she's the pregnant. Anesthetic.
Yeah, anesthetic – what – does anesthetic have fumes that might –
maybe 1993 anesthetic did.
I'm going to look into that because my sister has a friend who's an anesthetist who's having a baby. So she would know all about that.
Yeah.
So Anne Luby, excuse me, my little puppies are being very annoying. Just one second.
Goldie. Mabel.
She's looking at me like, who me? I'm just trying to protect you. So Anne Luby, she's amazing, isn't she? Like, isn't she just so incredible? She graduated from NIDA in 1998 and went straight to all these bit parts and then, of course, got this part on A Country Practice. But she's also been in a whole heap of films as well. Like, she was in the miniseries, the star of the miniseries, Simone de Beauvoir's Babies. Do you remember that? It was a big deal. Like, I think, I don't know what year, in the early 2000s, I think it was I remember that being like a big deal. But she's also been in musicals. She played one of the best roles ever in this very scandalous version of Company. So Company the Musical. There's this, do you want this little bit of gossip around? I mean, it's not gossip. I mean, it's on the public record. So Peter Cousins started this theatre company to do musicals called Kangaroo Musical Theatre or something like that. And their second or third musical that they did was Stephen Sondheim's Company, and they did it at Theatre Royal. David Campbell was the star, et cetera. They brought Stephen Sondheim out for it. And then one night one of the actors was sick, and Peter Cousins made the executive decision just to cut that actor out of the show and just, you know, everybody would have to act around it, which is just so outrageous. You can hear more about this story actually on Peter Iyer's podcast Stages, where he has Peter Cousins on talking about it. And I'm not joking. I had a sore jaw at the end of listening to it because I was so shocked by what Peter Cousins was saying. Like, as somebody who's like, I would be so outraged if a show that I had written an actor couldn't make, and they just went, we'll just do the show around that actor. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Let's just write them out.
Yeah, let's just write them out. Like, it's just so outrageous. Anyway, Anne Luby was in that. So if any of you ever meet her, ask her what the full story was, because there's all sorts of stuff around it. So Anne Luby went on to do loads and loads of things. So she was in the movie Disgrace with John Malkovich. She's been in Underbelly. She's been in Rake, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But she went back to study and is now a psychotherapist operating out of the Northern Beaches of New South Wales. And she does a special kind of therapy. And it sounds like that's what she does all the time now. I don't think that she does any acting anymore. But she, from all accounts, too, is a very lovely, lovely person. Also, you know, so we keep hearing. Not also we keep hearing. Yes, we keep hearing.
Of course she was a lovely person, because she was – yeah. One of the ACP
exactly.
family.
And she's somebody it would have been nice. Like when we amp this up in the next pandemic, she'll definitely be somebody that we track down to talk to for this podcast, don't you think? Like, I can't believe we haven't had her on. The other person I wanted to talk about, two other people, John Concannon, who played the not-so-new copper, Tom. So he was in the show for a couple of years. The show finished, and according to his CV, so this is interesting. You know, it's really hard sometimes to research people, because on IMDb, he's John Concannon without an H. Uh-huh. And then on LinkedIn, he's with an H. And you're like, are they the same person, or are they different people with a very similar, you know, trajectory? Anyway, John Concannon, according to his CV, now I can't find any trace of him after 2016. So he hasn't tweeted since 2013. I wasn't able to find any information about him on Facebook. So I know nothing about his personal life, as I tend to do about everybody else when I do a deep dive. But John Concannon, it's a hard one to say, because you want to say Kincannon, don't you? Anyway. He went back to uni in the mid-90s and he studied history and philosophy. I'm just reading this from his CV. As a writer, he was awarded funding under Film Queensland's New Writers Scheme, and he went on to win QTC's George Landon Playwriting Award. He then went on to be a TV writer, as quite a few of our ACP actors have done. So he wrote for Home and Away, for Medivac, etc. And the most recent sort of information I can find about him is that he was creating, writing and producing an ABC series called The Boffin, The Builder and The Bombardier. And that seems to be the photo he's got on his Twitter and the like. So it sounds like he's had one of those really sort of quintessentially Australian entertainment careers where you do a little bit of everything. But I wanted to finish up with Kim Wilson because Kim Wilson, it's like Kim Wilson was one of those actors that really seemed destined for something, you know, like she was in Brides of Christ and was kind of one of the many breakout talents really of that show. And then she went to A Country Practice from there. She's got such a long list of credits. And she was in the 90s, she had this theatre company in Sydney, which is one of the reasons I love theatre, called Pork Chop Productions, with Jeremy Sims, who was her boyfriend at the time. So she was she's kind of like the real deal, like doing theatre, doing TV, doing film. You know, she was in Flirting, the film Flirting. She was in all sorts of things. And then in the mid-90s or the late 90s, she just kind of vanished. And it was always – I had always thought that she had vanished because she was apparently the last person to see Michael Hutchence alive. Do you remember when Michael Hutchence died I think it was 1997?
I'm pretty sure it was 97, yeah.
And she was always sort of famed then as being the last person that saw him alive. I'm not sure if that's true. But in my reading today that I found, I thought she'd never talked about it. And in fact, one of the reasons I was always a bit reticent to get her on this podcast was I thought, we're going to have to ask her about that, and I don't want to, which we actually didn't need to, because we always kept conversation just to A Country Practice, really, didn't we? Like, we didn't even talk to Shane Withington and Anne Tenney about being married. You know, like we respected the whole, you know, the sort of, not that they laid parameters down for us, but we sort of respected what people wanted to talk about and such. I found an article in the Daily Telly where Kim Wilson talked about it explicitly, saying, and Michael Hutchence was referred to in this article as her boyfriend, which I was really surprised by because he, of course, was with Paula Yates at the time and that was what all the drama was around. And she said that she was so devastated when that happened that she just sort of fled overseas. She, interestingly, had a Churchill fellowship at the time.
Really?
Yeah. So I can't quite find what that was about. It says that it says it was an acting scholarship assisted by the Winston Churchill Fellowship. So maybe she got into one of those, like some school overseas.
Yeah.
And she went overseas and she basically just never came back. She worked in fashion for many years, for about 10 years for Leona Edmondson. Can you believe it? And now I think she does bits and pieces. She always did voiceovers. So a lot of the voiceovers that we hear in our ads have been Kim Wilson, but now I think she's got a fairly kind of quiet life. She is married to the guy that wrote Mystery Alaska, you know, that Russell Crowe movie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's married to him and they live fairly happily according to her Instagram, which I stalked in preparing for this. But what an interesting life. And I wonder, like, an acting career that was kind of derailed by this huge tragedy, you know, and I wonder what we would have seen from her had that not have happened or had she have not been linked to that. Because she's a really interesting actor, wasn't she? She sort of did so, and she was kind of like dangerous. Not in that character. Darcy's not really a dangerous character, but everything else, you know, she was always kind of like the slutty girl, wasn't she? Like the in all the movies. Wasn't she though?
Yep.
She was always
100%.
Yeah, she always played those kind of characters. So I think, you know, she might have done some really interesting stuff had that have not happened. But so that's Kim Wilson. So that's where everybody is. Not everybody is today, but that's where a few of our characters are today. Did you have fashions of the field today? I didn't.
I know. I keep forgetting. Did you look at anything, Chez?
I only had one, and that was in the first episode. Claire, the nurse, is wearing like a pale blue silk robe, like dressing gown sort of robe.
Yeah.
And that was about it. When she came on, I was like, oh, that's very nice. Mm. But yeah, apart from that, look, nothing.
The thing that I'll mention, and not because I particularly liked it, but it is just so 90s middle-aged woman. I don't know if you can call, is Penny Cook a middle-aged woman at that point? In 93.
Oh, and you know what? She's probably 35. How depressing is that?
Yes. 90s mum of children that aren't babies. Her top that she was wearing when she arrived in the valley was so, like, it was baggy, it was unflattering, it was like loud patterns that didn't really resemble any particular kind of shape or object. So I'm going to give that a shout out.
And the 90s headband.
And the 90s headband. It just spot on. Just spot on for the time. She probably bought it at Miller's.
Miller's the fashion club, yes, as it would have been known then.
Yes.
Kim, yes, no, I don't think I have any. I'm sorry. I don't think I have any because I think that it was like, I just don't like this era of ACP fashion.
I think given this is our last episode, Mel, I think you might need to give a shout out at the very least to how did the thatch go on his wedding day, on his third wedding day?
It was beautiful. Like, I mean, that hair, that silver masterpiece just gets better year after year after year after year after year on that show. And as we all know, because we have, you know, Shane Porteous has been so generous with his time for this podcast and for also for the Shane Porteous Appreciation Society Facebook page, which you need to go to right now that Chez runs.
Yes.
That hair has just held out.
Yeah.
And in the most spectacular way. Like, it is just the most beautiful hair, isn't it? It's so beautiful. It's really unfair the way men get to age so beautifully with their hair. You know, when they have a full head like that, you know, I was watching Married at First Sight last night and there were a lot of balding deniers on that show. You know what I mean? A lot of men losing their hair and really fighting it with some comb forwards, you know, like lots of that.
Mm. And I just, so many men get to shave their head too and it looks great.
Yeah, it looks fantastic.
Men with a shaved bald head.
Me too.
Looks fantastic.
I own the baldness.
Yeah, I'm totally into it. But I find it, the older we get, a head full of hair on a man is just a marvel to me because it exists so rarely. You
are
know,
you hair shaming? Are you,
No.
It's like,
no, it's just one of those things that I, no, because, you know, again, I also find bald men very, very, very attractive. Like Stanley Tucci to me is up there with Shane Porteous in terms of heartthrobbery. But God, I just love, like, I've got this friend who's in his 50s, early 50s, who's got like a big head of hair and I just want to touch it all the time. And he said to me once, he got a new hair product and he's like, feel this. And I was like, I was so excited about getting my hands on it. Like, because it was just so amazing. I think that, you know, that love of a silver full head has probably come from Dr. Terry. So I'm gonna give it a 12 out of 10.
Nice. Well, Shane will be jealous of his hair once again, as he very funnily emailed to us after he heard us talking about it on a country podcast.
So embarrassing. Sorry to objectify you. I mean, I don't know what my dog's barking at. I'm sorry. Well, shall we? I'm so sad to wind this up now. I was hoping, you know, this is our last, like we said, this is our last episode for a very, very, very long time. Well, just until the next pandemic comes around, which is hopefully in 100 years time. That's not, you know, hopefully there's no pandemics coming to us. But I would just like to say thank you so much to all of our listeners, particularly those who've got in touch and said how much they love the podcast. Yeah. That has meant the world to us. It has absolutely meant the world to us. And if you've engaged with us on Facebook about it, or like, I can't tell you how important that was to us. Getting through the pandemic to begin with, it was spectacular, and onwards. So thank you so much for that. And thank you, Kim, for being such an amazing sparring partner over the 2 years that we've done this podcast together. It's just been wonderful. And, of course, we've got to thank our dear Chez Robbie, who a beautiful friendship we've found as a result of this.
I'm never going to forget the moment that I was standing outside my local cafe and I was just about to take a sip of coffee and I looked at my phone and there was Chez had messaged us a photo of a crocheted Terrence Shane Porteous, just in a very risque pose. Like, you know, he was looking very like, come hither.
He was on the doctor's lounge, wasn't he?
Had I had coffee in my mouth at that moment, I would have spat it out. It was so funny. And I feel like at that moment, a friendship was formed. And thank you so much, Chez. That was just all brilliant. Right. And thank you for everything you've done.
Oh, you're welcome. And speaking of risque dolls, I've really got a strong urge in this, you know, Australian television history to recreate Jack Thompson's Cleo centrefold in crochet.
Ooh,
you know, that's just a thing. I think, you know, I should probably do that as my next project.
Oh, yes. And hardly endorse.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. And we will be back. Will we be back sometime?
You don't know.
I don't know. But thank you so much. Oh, and thanks to Mike
Pajanic. Just a tease,
Melanie. Thanks to Mike Pajanic for our wonderful theme, Nate Edmondson as well for his riff on the theme. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Chez.
So, thanks, Goldie. Thanks, Mabel.
Oh, can you believe this dog? Can you believe her?
Oh, see you
guys. Thanks,
guys.
Thank you.
Bye.